Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
We have probably the biggest opportunities to make huge advances for our state, maybe in the history of our state.
A congressional budget bill would strip environmental protections to allow oil drilling and mining in Alaska. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 5th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a lawsuit claims Alaska prisons are unconstitutionally denying health care to inmates.
About 96% of the population goes home one day, and we're not sending them home in good shape. We're sending them home in worse shape than when we booked them.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. Republicans in the U.S. House are trying to clear hurdles for Alaska oil drilling and mining with a budget reconciliation bill that's written to thwart environmental lawsuits. The bill, for instance, mandates 4 new lease sales in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge under terms the first Trump administration decided on. Only this time, if the bill passes as proposed, the law would declare that the leases comply with a raft of environmental laws and no one but the state of Alaska or the leaseholder could go to court. The House Natural Resources Committee takes up the Alaska drilling parts of the bill tomorrow. It's part of the Republican budget reconciliation measure, or as President Trump calls it, one big beautiful bill. The sweeping legislation includes much of his agenda, including tax cuts and immigration enforcement, as well as rolling back environmental rules in Alaska and around the country. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan told Alaska business and industry representatives last week that with Republicans controlling the White House and Congress, Alaska stands to benefit.
We have probably the biggest opportunities to make huge advances for our state, maybe in the history of our state.
That's from a Facebook video his office posted. Among the Alaska provisions in the reconciliation bill is the removal of environmental restrictions that the Biden administration imposed in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. The bill also mandates approval of the Ambler Road Corridor across federal land in northwest Alaska, and it requires at least 6 petroleum lease sales in Cook Inlet. Environmental groups are gearing up for battle. Andy Motoro is director of policy for the Alaska Wilderness League. He says the bill is an aggressive assault on Alaska's environment, but also on American democracy.
If they get what they want through it, it would let, you know, leaseholders and oil companies access the courts while Alaskans concerned about fish, wildlife, public lands would be locked out. And that's just shocking.
This type of bill is immune from filibuster in the Senate, so it could pass both chambers if Republicans unite behind it. Some Republicans, though, object to it because it would add trillions to the deficit over 10 years. Potential cuts to Medicaid are controversial, too. Well, the Alaska Department of Corrections is the largest provider of health and behavioral health care in the state, and now the ACLU of Alaska is suing Governor Mike Dunleavy and 2 DOC employees for failing to provide adequate health care for people who are incarcerated. As Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra reports, the suit is a culmination of a years-long investigation.
About 4,400 Alaskans are incarcerated in the state, and the Department of Corrections, or DOC, is legally required to provide adequate health care to people who are incarcerated. But Megan Edge with the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, of Alaska says that isn't happening.
It's shocking how many just basic human needs are not being met, medications that are not in on time. We've had undiagnosed illnesses that have caused cancer. We have seen people with all sorts of physical disabilities and illnesses and things going on that DOC is not addressing.
The ACLU's class action lawsuit claims that the Department of Corrections has failed to provide adequate health care for those in its care. It claims that failure, quote, creates a substantial risk of serious harm and endangers the health, safety, and lives of incarcerated people, end quote. The lawsuit claims that the current DOC health care system is unconstitutionally denying adequate health, mental health, and dental care to people who are incarcerated. And it asked the state to immediately make changes to their systems to remedy that. The Department of Corrections declined to comment on the lawsuit. But during an interview last fall, DOC Health Director Adam Rutherford said it's an exceptional challenge to provide health care for the population.
We reflect the community, but it's also a concentration of all those highest problems. You know, folks that struggle with addiction, folks that are diagnosed with mental health, the acuity level, the number of folks with Hep C. So the problems that you see out in the community are concentrated and often magnified here within our system.
According to the lawsuit, one person wasn't given glasses for their severe myopia. Another was allegedly denied care for diabetes and told to simply exercise. A prisoner with post-traumatic stress disorder experiencing night terrors was allegedly denied sleeping medication. The suit is also filed on behalf of at least six people who died in DOC custody as a result of what the lawsuit describes as inadequate health care. Kelsey Green is one of the people named in the lawsuit who died under DOC's care. Green's father, John, says she died of dehydration while detoxing from opioids because she was alone.
The night she died, they put her in a segregated cell by herself. Someone was told to get her a cellmate. That never happened. And when they came and checked on her in the morning, she was naked underneath the call button, stuck in a position with her hand up where she couldn't reach the call button.
According to the lawsuit, requesting medical care is an overly complicated process. People who are incarcerated must ask a guard or staff member. The suit says DOC staff discouraged people from formally requesting care and in several cases distributed a fake form that asked the, quote, whiner if they wanted help from their, quote, mommy for their, quote, sissy feelings. That system is problematic, according to Dr. William Weber. He's a physician and works for the national nonprofit Medical Justice Alliance.
Guards or other prison staff are not medically trained. And really, from a health privacy standpoint, guards generally should not be privy to information about patients' health, just in the same way you wouldn't talk to like a security guard at the hospital about your medical concerns.
And he says one of the fundamental challenges for incarcerated people is that they are entirely dependent on the correction system for their care.
You can't just go to another hospital. You can't just go to another ER. You don't have access to the same healthcare resources. Most patients could look online, or most patients could talk to their physician or talk to their friends.
Edge from the ACLU says that poor healthcare for incarcerated people impacts everyone in Alaska.
We spend a ton of money on our correctional system. About 96% of the population goes home one day, and we're not sending them home in good shape. We're sending them home in worse shape than when we booked them. To me, that is a huge sign that our system is absolutely failing.
Edge says she hopes the lawsuit helps create reforms in the Department of Corrections healthcare system. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
The 2026 race for Alaska governor is officially underway. Former Fairbanks Republican State Senator Click Bishop filed a letter of intent to run for governor with campaign regulators today. Bishop is the first to throw his hat in the ring for the campaign to succeed term-limited Governor Mike Dunleavy. Bishop says he's still developing his policy platform, but he says his top priority is clear.
If you had a number one, a number two, and a number three, it's affordable energy, affordable energy, affordable energy. You know, it's just, it sucks so much money out of working people's paychecks and big corporations' paychecks.
Bishop says education is another priority, especially career and technical education, as are the economy and fisheries. Bishop says he's planning a series of listening sessions around the state this summer and fall to hear from Alaskans and develop his campaign message. Bishop represented a large portion of the interior during his 12 years in the Alaska Senate from 2013 to 2024 when he didn't seek re-election. Bishop caucused with all Republican and multi-party coalitions during his time in the upper house of the legislature. Bishop also touts his experience as an engineer and as state labor commissioner under Governors Sarah Palin and Sean Parnell. He pitches himself as a consensus builder who knows the state and the issues facing it.
Yeah, I've been a Republican registered since I was 18 years old, but I'll also say that I'm an Alaskan first and a Republican second.
Asked to compare himself against Alaska's two most recent governors, independent Bill Walker and Republican Mike Dunleavy, Bishop says he has commonalities with both. Bishop is not the only Republican in the race. Dunleavy's Lieutenant Governor Nancy Dahlstrom filed a letter of intent to run for governor this afternoon. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a festival in Nome brings together musicians from rural high schools all over Western Alaska.
When we come to this festival and I'm able to bring kids here, they are getting an experience here that they don't get at home.
That's ahead. Stay with us. A teenager has died in Bethel after police say a snow machine he was driving sank in a pond and he was unable to swim to safety late Saturday. 17-year-old James J. McMillan was accompanied by three adults at the time of the incident, according to police. Police say McMillan and two of the three adults were taking turns driving two snow machines across the surface of the pond, known as skipping, when a snow machine driven by McMillan sank. Police have not publicly released the name of McMillan or the people who accompanied him, but his family confirmed his death to KYUK Radio in Bethel. The incident occurred at a pond off the Chief Eddie Hoffman Highway and adjacent to Bethel's Public Health Center. The man-made pond periodically fills with water and was at least 6 feet deep at the time of the incident. Police say McMillan was unable to swim to safety due to wearing heavy cold weather gear. Two men who had also been riding across the pond attempted to swim to McMillan's location but were also hampered by cold weather gear and had to turn back, according to police. Police say no foul play is suspected, but that an investigation is ongoing. Officials with the Alaska Marine Highway System say repairs to the state's oldest ferry are too expensive. Craig Tornga is the marine director. He says seeking funding to repair the 62-year-old Matanuska would compete with other future projects.
Funding is tight, and will those dollars stay there in the rural ferry program, you know, with the new administration? And we just don't want to be competing against our long reach plan.
Tornga was speaking to the Alaska Marine Highway Operations Board during an April 25th meeting. The nine-member board makes recommendations to the state's Department of Transportation, which controls the ferry system. The board made a formal recommendation that the Matanuska be officially retired from the fleet. At the bare minimum, the ferry would require at least $45 million to return to service and around $130 million if it's certified for international travel. The ferry's problems surfaced during an overhaul 2 years ago and then multiplied. Surveys of the ship showed asbestos in the crew quarters and deteriorating steel throughout. The Matanuska would need about 125,000 pounds of steel in repairs. Operations Board Chair Juanetta Ayers says fixing it would be too challenging.
You know, it's regrettable. It will be a sad day when the Matanuska is no longer in the fleet.
The Matanuska is a large ferry carrying up to 450 passengers and dozens of vehicles. It used to be one of Southeast's mainliners, sailing the route from Lynn Canal north of Juneau all the way south to Prince Rupert, British Columbia. But for more than 2 years, the Matanuska has been used as a hotel ship for ferry workers in Ketchikan. Tornga says it's very useful right now, but it's still too expensive to operate long term. Alaska saw a record number of opioid deaths in 2023, but non-fatal overdoses declined at the end of last year. The exact reasons for that are unclear, but could be thanks to naloxone distribution and education. That's something that the Ketchikan Wellness Coalition has been focused on through free monthly trainings. KRBD's Michael Finelli attended a recent training to learn how to administer the life-saving nasal spray and has this story.
Community paramedic Ben Watson starts off the training with a quick biology lesson.
Typically, opiates and opioids, there's both, one's synthetic, one's natural producing. They'll bind to your receptors.
Watson explains that opioids bind to the receptors in your brain responsible for maintaining the respiratory rate. They can slow it down enough to stop your breathing entirely.
The danger with overdoses is it inhibits your respiratory drive. You slowly start breathing more shallow and less often. And so typically it's over time you're slowly suffocating.
Naloxone is an overdose antidote, commonly referred to by the popular brand name Narcan. It works by bonding more strongly to those same brain receptors, replacing the opioid and reversing the effects of an overdose. The synthetic drug fentanyl is driving the current opioid epidemic. It's far more potent than other opioids. In Alaska, organizations like Project Hope have distributed thousands of overdose reversal kits throughout the state. Several organizations in Ketchikan give them out for free in an attempt to equip as many people as possible in the fight against fentanyl. Tara Taro is with one of those organizations, the Ketchikan Wellness Coalition. She says naloxone is easy to use. There's just a few things to keep in mind.
So first and foremost, always call 911.
Taro says you should do that even before you administer treatment.
Naloxone is not a cure-all. of an overdose. It temporarily stops an overdose. You can go back into overdose depending on how much drugs you have in your system.
If a person isn't breathing and their pupils are small, I mean, it's very unlikely it's anything other than an overdose.
Watson says to next look for the telltale signs of an opioid overdose, like tiny pinpoint pupils and shallow breathing. Even if you mistake the signs, naloxone won't harm the patient.
The good thing about Narcan is there's not a whole lot of risk to administering Narcan to a patient who isn't overdosing.
In fact, Watson says there are Good Samaritan laws that legally protect anyone who is reasonably trying to treat an overdose. Administering the naloxone is fairly simple. It works like a single-dose nasal spray. Watson invites the trainees to practice on a medical dummy.
I brought my mannequin helper here. If you want, you can come over here and squirt that into this guy's nose. Two fingers up top, one your thumb down below, and you're going to have your two fingers resting up against the nostril of the patient.
Taro emphasizes always prioritizing your own well-being. Only approach a patient if you feel safe. And as soon as you administer naloxone, Taro says to back up because that patient may become agitated.
It may feel like to you that you are, I'm saving this person's life. Look at me go. They might not feel that way coming out of it. So they might not be happy that you took that high away.
Taro says if you're able to communicate with the person once they come to, let them know what happened and that you called EMS. But there's a good chance they turn down those services. Taro says more often than not, people who survive an overdose are not ready to seek treatment. But the point is to meet people where they are, to give them that opportunity.
If we can keep people alive enough long enough, hopefully they will make a decision for a better path. And the only way we can do that is by providing these kits to as many people as we can and letting them know that we are here for them in any way that they need.
Watson adds that he just helped a patient, who he gives Narcan to weekly, sign up for treatment.
It does work.
The Ketchikan Wellness Coalition has another naloxone training scheduled for May 28th at the downtown fire station. Free overdose kits can be picked up from several Project Hope partners in town, including the police and fire departments and the Ketchikan Indian community. In Ketchikan, I'm Michael Finelli.
A program that monitors toxic poisoning in subsistence marine harvests in the Aleutians has halted pending a federal review. The Alaska Native tribe that runs the program says it puts consumers of traditional seafood at risk, including in Unalaska, where a fatal shellfish poisoning occurred nearly 5 years ago. KUCB's Sophia Stewart-Rossi reports.
In the summer of 2020, a person in Unalaska collected mussels and snails on a local beach and ate them. Hours later, they died from paralytic shellfish poisoning, or PSP. The shellfish contained extremely high toxin levels, causing symptoms of numbness, weakness, and pain. The person ended up dying despite being medevaced to a hospital in Anchorage. To prevent tragedies like this, a program monitors harvest areas in the region for shellfish poisoning. It's run by the Kinnick tribe in south-central Alaska for nearly two decades. The program employs technicians in Unalaska and other communities across Alaska, like Sandpoint, King Cove, and Chignik Lagoon. These technicians collect weekly samples of blue mussels, butter clams, and other marine organisms. But the project was placed on pause in April as the federal government investigates its legitimacy to continue funding. The program was funded by the Bureau of Indian Affairs through the Tribal Climate Resilience Solicitation. In an email to KUCB, they say that under President Donald Trump's leadership, the U.S. Department of Interior is working to cut, quote, bureaucratic waste and ensure taxpayer dollars are spent efficiently. The email adds that projects are being individually assessed by period of performance, criticality, and other criteria. Bruce Wright is the chief scientist at the tribe. He's concerned about the suspension of one of the program's projects, the Paralytic Shellfish Poisoning Risk Management Project.
Without us being out there and, you know, alerting people that there's a risk or testing their subsistence harvest, we're worried about them. So we hope the project starts up.
Technicians test for dangerous neurotoxins produced by microscopic marine alga called Alexandrium. These naturally occurring toxins can move up the food chain, affecting various marine life, including salmon and crabs. The monitoring program is particularly crucial for Unalaskans because the Aleutians regularly have higher PSP levels than the rest of the state, Wright says. He thinks the rise in PSP in recent years may be related to warming ocean waters.
And I don't think our ocean temperatures are going to go down. And we don't have a way to control the Alexandrian blooms. That just means we have to figure out a way to adapt to these changes, you know, and people are good at adapting. We can figure these things out.
The monitoring project was created to warn people that traditionally harvest foods aren't as safe as they once were. The tribe has issued warnings in multiple languages during high bloom periods to reach as many people as possible, especially at fish processing plants where folks might not already know about PSP and locally harvested foods.
Hundreds of people have died in the state from PSP, and probably thousands have been sickened or had symptoms. So it's serious.
When the project was active, people from around the state could send samples of their collected harvest for testing, freeze the rest, and wait for safety notifications from the tribe. For now, the Kinnick tribe advises harvesters to not eat anything that could have high levels of PSP, like mussels, clams, and scallops, and suggests freezing harvest until testing resumes. The tribe is also exploring state funding options. In Unalaska, I'm Sophia Stewart Rossi.
About 60 high school students from rural Alaska met in Nome last month to attend a regional music festival. The event brought students from Western Alaska communities together to sing and play choral, band, and ensemble music. Giselle Moto is a high school freshman from Deering, a classical guitarist, and a KOTZ announcer who played at the event and has this story.
In the Nome Belt High School gym, teenagers, some dressed up in button-down shirts, others in matching Arctic looks or cuss books, play the song Adventure Awaits. And for many students like me who live off of the wood system, coming here to perform is an adventure. Samantha Tarowak is the band and choir director for the Bering Sea community of Unalakleet. She says music festivals like this are important, especially for smaller communities.
In Unalakleet, my students do not get very many opportunities to play with other musicians. And so when we come to this festival and I'm able to bring kids here, they are getting an experience here that they don't get at home.
Four other schools were at the event: Nome, Bethel, Dillingham, and Kotzebue. Jade Slater is the band and choir director from Dillingham. She was chaperoning 10 students.
Teenagers have big emotions.
This moody tune performed by all the band students is called Atropa Belladonna.
And as the adult, I have to find the best way to help them out with their big emotions. I'm also in charge of making sure they're all safe.
Brandon Lissando is the band director for the event. He spent time with the bands from each school, coaching them with breathing exercises and making sure they play the correct notes.
I asked the kids at the beginning of the week, you know, just trust a little bit. I promise I will ask you to do things that you have never done before, and it might be a little weird, but eventually you'll see how it'll apply and make things better.
The students just had 2 days to learn new musical pieces before performing in front of the other students and the Nome community. Some of the students performed in choral groups and played instruments. Richard Sargent coordinated the event.
There are about 11 students that are combined band and chorus that are getting both experiences of that, which is really cool and really unique, just so everybody's able to do what they want to do.
It was the first time Sargent, who recently moved to Nome from the Lower 48, organized an event like this in Alaska. He says he likes the collaborative nature of the festival.
I see it as an opportunity for somebody to focus on something at their level and see the growth with feedback at the end of the tunnel.
There was also a competitive aspect. Solo and ensemble performances were graded, with the best performers earning the honor of superior, and a chance to travel to Anchorage to attend the statewide solo and ensemble music festival. Choir director Tyron Jovet judged the performances. She says she enjoyed it.
Because sometimes you go and you do a solo and ensemble and you don't get to work with the student afterwards. You just fill out the sheet, you fill out the comments, say nothing, and they leave, which I don't think is super beneficial for anybody.
Jovet says working with students after performing allows them to practice and build their skills for future performances. But as a judge, she says it's not always about following a rubric.
I'm not looking to experience a performance that ticks boxes, right? Like, oh, they played that in tune? Check. They played this note right? Check. Because music isn't a checkbox. Right? It provokes feelings.
In total, 13 students that performed at the regional event qualified for a statewide festival on May 8th. Reporting from Nome, I am Giselle Moto.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Eric Stone in Juneau, Rachel Cassandra in Anchorage, Evan Erickson in Bethel, Angela Denny in Petersburg, Michael Finelli in Ketchikan, Sophia Stewart-Rossi in Unalaska, and Giselle Moto in Nome. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.